From the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, it's Politically Georgia. I'm Tia Mitchell. Today, as college campuses in Georgia and across the country grapple with student unrest over the Israeli-Hamas war, we'll talk to Morehouse Provost Kendrick Brown about his school's plans to deal with controversy during President Biden's upcoming visit.
I'm Bill Nigut. Then a conversation with Trump administration appointee Carlos Trujillo. As Trump's ambassador to the Organization of American States, Trujillo is often described as the former president's closest link to the Latino community. We'll ask him about Trump's appeal to those voters in this year's election.
Plus, a look at Vice President Kamala Harris's visit to Atlanta today. We invite you to follow us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts so you never miss an episode of Politically Georgia. This is Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
In Atlanta, one voice has stood out for over four decades. An AJC original, The Monica Pearson Show.
Let's talk about how you got to ESPN.
Revealing interviews.
You are known as America's doctor, but I want to know who you were before that.
When you have a different name, you have different color skin, it can be tough.
With Atlanta's most famous faces as you've never seen them before.
I'm telling my story. This is the American dream.
The Monica Pearson Show, streaming now on AJC.com.
Hip-hop is a product of black people. It's a product of black song and celebration.
The Atlanta Journal-Constitution presents
hip-hop's most pulled elements are pulled from the South.
A Southern hip-hop story.
We always go back to that moment of the Source Awards.
Everybody wants your rhythm, but they don't want your blues.
The biggest names in hip-hop.
Atlanta is still the mecca for hip-hop.
50 years.
No one can deny.
One film.
The power of the South now.
The South got something to say. Streaming now at AJC.com/hip-hop.
From the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, this is Politically Georgia, setting the stakes and the agenda for Georgia politics. I'm the AJC's Tia Mitchell. Now, today is the start of early in-person voting, so be ready to cast your ballots. We're going to chat more about that later. But first, Bill, you and I are still in recovery. We had a great weekend with other members of Team AJC and some Atlanta all-stars for the White House Correspondents' Dinner.
Yes, it was really a great evening, Tia. And of course, you were our guide throughout our visit to Washington, as you've been before. And it was wonderful to be in the Hilton Ballroom with, 2,300 of our closest friends. But the guests we invited, who we didn't want to name before the event, we had wonderful people. I mean, we had Dallas Austin, Jermaine Dupri, two of the preeminent hip-hop rap artists in this country. We had Representative Lucy McBath, who I got to sit next to at the dinner and really enjoyed talking to. Jeff Duncan, the Republican who was one of the first people to turn against Donald Trump in this state. And then we had our own AJC team. So it was just I love being at that table with all of you and watching the night unfold.
Yeah, and it was a good night. Listen, I know that there's a lot going on in the world. We, of course, acknowledge those reporters who are being detained over in other countries unlawfully. We, of course, acknowledge that there were protests, people outside of the venue. But it's a night to honor journalism. Yes, there were jokes and Biden and made jokes and Colin jokes, but it also, we celebrated some amazing journalists in journalism. And there were the scholarship recipients. That is really what the night's all about. But it's also fun to get dressed up and hang out with folks you wouldn't normally get to hang out with. But so thank you for flying down, Bill, again. I know you're going to continue to recuperate from that whirlwind weekend, but we're going to move forward. We have a jam-packed show. And just as you all came to Washington, Washington is coming to Atlanta. We've got some high-profile visits from the Biden administration coming up this next couple of weeks, starting today with Vice President Kamala Harris. She's going to be in Atlanta. Our colleague Greg Bluestein is going to join us a little bit later in the show to talk about the vice president's visit. But let's talk about how in a few weeks, President Biden himself is coming to Atlanta. He is going to be the commencement speaker at Morehouse College. And again, his visit does come as protests have been growing, particularly on college campuses, as students and faculty and others, you know, criticize the Biden administration's handling of the Israel-Hamas war. So let's welcome Morehouse Provost Kendrick Brown. He is here to discuss the ceremony, the pomp and circumstance, but also how politics are going to impact it all. Welcome, Dr. Brown.
Thank you so much, Tia, for having me on the show. I'm appreciative of being here.
Well, we appreciate you joining us. So first off, can you start just for the non-academics listening? You know, I'm a proud FAMU graduate, so showing you some HBCU love, of course. But tell us, what is your role as provost at Morehouse? And what's your role in planning the graduation?
Sure. At Morehouse, I'm the provost and senior vice president of academic affairs, which means that I am the chief academic officer of the college. That means I work with faculty, staff, of course, with students to ensure we're delivering our educational mission to ensure that our students lead lives of leadership and service when they leave the college. Within commencement, certainly I am on the stage, but I coordinate with a number of colleagues, our vice president of external relations, as well as my own associate provost, to ensure that commencement is indeed a celebration of the accomplishments of these students who spent the last 4 years working hard and doing all that they're supposed to do to be able to go out into the world and make their mark.
Provost Brown, first of all, thank you for being here. And I do think it's worth pointing out that there are administrators at other universities, Emory as one example, right here in our own backyard, who have not felt comfortable talking openly to the media. And I think it's a tribute to you and your university that you are speaking about the visit of President Biden and understanding that there are some tough questions about his coming here. We should also point out that just this morning, students at the University of Georgia, after the trouble last week at Emory, tried to establish a tent encampment, and police broke them up. I think there were more than a dozen, perhaps more, we'll learn, arrests. So, Dr. Brown, in the midst of all of that, although I know you had a meeting on campus, your president had a meeting on campus earlier this week to talk about the visit, again, engaging with students, there were quite a few people, according to reporting from Capital B, quite a few students who were there who were very upset about his coming. But that's different than having people set up an encampment, having tried to stop activities on the campus. So far, you've been able to avoid that. How have you done that?
I think what is important for us at Morehouse is that we very much value and appreciate the strong opinions that our students, our faculty, and our staff have. We encourage them to have those opinions. And I think the role of a college is to bring those strong perspectives into dialogue safely and certainly without disrupting the operations of the college. And we've had that commitment. We encourage folks to express themselves, and we'll do our best as a college to ensure things are safe. But college is meant to be that space. And I think having that attitude has enabled us to have dialogue with our students, our faculty, and our staff.
So you talked about encouraging free thought, and that brings to mind, you know, Morehouse and the AUC more broadly is kind of known for its activism, these colleges in the cradle of the civil rights movement. But on so many issues, you often hear about AUC students speaking out, and not always on quote unquote progressive issues. Like, I remember, you know, there have been rappers who've been booed off campus for having controversial, you know, misogynist lyrics, for example. Can you tell me about that legacy and how you strike that balance between, encouraging free thought, but also protecting safety?
I think you put your finger on it. We are, as the alma mater of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and also, of course, for Senator Raphael Warnock, we have a legacy, and we have many proud alums who've engaged in public advocacy and activism. That is not something new for us at Morehouse and at the AUC. And so we understand that our students are going to act within that tradition that we've cultivated. But we also know and we trust our students to be able to keep in mind the importance of community, that even when you have strong opinions that might be in conflict with others who are part of your community, you still uphold safety and you still ensure that these voices can be heard, even if you disagree with them. And so for us, really navigating that space involves trusting our community, being cognizant of our role for ensuring safety, but also understanding at heart, we're an educational space and we've got to provide those different views to be able to come into contact and to be able to engage. So that, I think, enables us to have a foundation for how we interact with those in our community.
I mentioned the meeting that you all held with students the other evening, I think. Chauncey Alcorn, the reporter for Capital B, was there to report on it. And I want to read you just one quote from that meeting, and because I think it raises a question I'd love to hear your response to. A student named Jason May got up and asked your president, David Thomas, he said, "How do you justify what you're going to bestow on President Biden on our behalf?" He gets an honorary degree as a commencement speaker. And he went on and he said that he believes the president is basically, quote, a war criminal. And he argued that giving him a platform at Morehouse makes the school complicit in what's happening in Gaza. So how do you respond to that? That giving the president a forum at a time when there is so much dissension over the administration's ongoing support for Israel, when the Israelis, when the Netanyahu government is continuing to decimate wide stretches of Gaza, what is there anything to having the president come at a time like this? Any realistic concern about whether he should be honored at this moment?
From the perspective of Morehouse College, we have a strong, enduring commitment to social justice. We also have a commitment to ensuring that Morehouse students, faculty, and staff in our larger community can engage with the highest leaders in government to be able to voice their viewpoints. That does not always mean they're going to be in agreement with those leaders. And so President Biden coming here, it does give a spotlight to what Morehouse believes and being able to provide an opportunity for voices to be heard that otherwise would not be heard. As we're considering, of course, President Biden coming here, we have this range of perspectives that's being expressed. I think that is healthy for the country. I think that is healthy for our college. And I think that role is extremely important. And so seeing this as an opportunity to be able to discuss, to be able to engage, to be able to question, this is what's being afforded by having President Biden as the commencement speaker.
If I could follow up on that, at other universities, as I'm sure you know, the pro-Palestinian demonstrators have, in addition to condemning America's support for Israel during this war, despite the fact that President Biden is doing as much as he can to get Benjamin Netanyahu to back off the massive destruction that he's perpetrating on the Palestinians. But my question was going to be, we also know that there's been a lot of anti-Semitic comments attached to people's anger over Israel. And as a Jew, I would argue there's a big difference between being Jewish and being a Zionist who supports what Netanyahu is doing in the way he's handling the war. Have you been hearing much? How is the anti-Semitism conversation occurring at Morehouse? I'd be surprised if there aren't some anti-Semitic observations being made on the campus at this point.
I think there's a range of different perspectives that get expressed. I have not heard an anti-Semitic voice being expressed in the strong opinions that folks have. Certainly, if that were the case, then the obligation of our college is to indeed confront that, because as an HBCU that's committed to Black men and men of color, we know very well how folks can be impacted by history of discrimination and systematic bias. And so being, of course, aware of that, understanding that expressing your opinion does not mean you get to express hate speech, is extremely important. And I think that is one aspect of this debate that we all have to be cognizant of, to ensure that, yes, we are expressing this healthy range of opinion, but not doing it in a way that's going to lead to threats and to curtailing the freedom of other individuals who historically have been adversely impacted.
So I want to go back, Provost Brown, to the actual decision to offer the invitation to President Biden. You know, there was some viral posts on social media that said Biden started scrambling after he saw former President Trump at the Chick-fil-A near campus speaking with young voters. But we know these things don't happen nearly as quickly. And this had to have been weeks, if not months, of planning. When did you all first reach out to the Biden administration? We should note, he spoke at Howard University's commencement last spring, another prestigious HBCU. So when did those conversations start, and what made you guys decide to make your attempt to probably the most coveted graduation speaker any year is the President of the United States?
My understanding is that President Biden gives 3 commencement speeches a year. He has made a commitment to giving 1 at an HBCU, and then a second one typically happens at a military academy. Mm-hmm. And so being able to have the sitting president, President Biden, as a commencement speaker, that is very high profile. The invitation was extended in September of last year. We actually got, I guess you would call it a soft confirmation in December, and certainly didn't get any full confirmation until just recently. So as you mentioned, it is a process. It is not something that happens right away. It was not something that was influenced by President Trump, or I should say candidate Trump, being an individual who came on our campus.
So, and along those lines, how are you guys preparing logistically for the ceremony? You know, there have been protests at other Biden events where he's heckled by people in the crowd, or people unfurl banners or stand up and they have on T-shirts. That happened to Senator Warnock during a Sunday morning service, for example. What will and won't be tolerated? And what do you guys expect the day of the actual ceremony?
Well, foremost, what folks have to have in mind is that we will be working with the Secret Service. When the president comes to your campus, there are security protocols that you have to follow. But what I will also say is that during the ceremony itself, our faculty, our staff, our students, as long as we're able to guarantee everyone's safety and we don't disrupt this celebration that's meant to acknowledge our students, then, of course, they can express themselves. That is what our community does, and that's what we encourage them to do.
You know, there is an interesting intersection here between our conversation with you and the fact, of course, that the vice president will be here later today, as Greg Bluestein, who's going to be covering her, will tell us a little later in the show. Her main purpose in this, her 12th visit to Atlanta, the Atlanta area, is to talk about the Biden administration's efforts to work more, to give employment opportunities to Black men. There's always this concern about whether Black men are going to be supportive of a Biden in this election. Having said that, the fact that the president is coming to Morehouse College, some have suggested, is a token political gesture, that it's an easy way for him to get in front of a group of Black students, Black faculty, administrators, and try to make a point about his administration's support for the Black community. But we also know it's true that there are many Black voters out there who continue to vote for Democrats, but who also say, at some point, we have to stop this because they talk about helping us. It isn't really practically, it isn't happening that way. To what extent do you worry that this is an easy visit for President Biden in terms of an opportunity to speak to the Black community?
Well, the reason that we invited President Biden here, the reason we invite any speaker to come to commencement, is that we believe they have something to say to encourage our graduates as they go out into the world. So I hope this speech would not be about making a case or making a campaign. It should be about our students. It should be about what they've accomplished and what they're going to accomplish as they go out into the world. And so folks can have that perspective. But really, President Biden would be in the best line if he were to remember that this truly is about commencement. And this truly is meant to be a celebration. And that's what our graduates want more than anything else. They want a prominent leader to speak to them, to talk about how they can make a mark in the world and what's important as we move into the future.
Yeah, I think that's an important point. And quite frankly, that was one of the criticisms of President Biden's commencement speech in Howard last year, was that it was a little bit too political, a little bit too campaigny, and not enough about actually being that commencement encouraging speaker. So I'm sure Biden and his team have taken notes since last year. I wanted to ask you, there have been petitions going around. You've heard from students and faculty, both in favor and opposed. Was there any discussion or at least a gut check amongst Morehouse administrators to say, should we rescind the invitation? Do we want to move forward?
I think as we've had these conversations, we had last week a town hall involving our president and students. We also had a meeting that I was a part of between the president and our faculty, and folks had an opportunity to express things. There are, of course, opinions saying that we should rescind the invitation, but there are a number of individuals who recognize this opportunity and the prominence of the speaker and an opportunity for Morehouse to highlight its mission and to be able to use this venue to ask important questions. And so from that perspective, we have not at this point thought about rescinding anything, but certainly we are listening closely to our community as we further commit to this event that's going to be happening soon for commencement.
Well, wait, if you don't mind my asking, you're not going to rescind the invitation, but you're listening closely to the community. What does that mean? What are you hearing from them? What are you hoping to hear? And how could it adjust what unfolds when the president comes?
So what we're hearing is the range of perspectives. And of course, we're hearing individuals who, for instance, want to ensure that the commencement address will be about the students. Mm-hmm. We're certainly hearing from individuals who want to ensure there's a safe space for folks to express a range of different perspectives or a range of different opinions if they have them. How can they do that during the event? That's the listening that we're doing. And it would behoove us to continue to listen to our community as we head up to the commencement.
Thank you.
All right. Well, we know how busy you are, Provost Brown. We thank you so much for joining us this morning. And we look forward to talking to you more. And of course, we'll be there. The AJC will be there at commencement. So congratulations to the Morehouse graduates.
Thank you so much. Take care.
All right. Thank you. We're going to have a take a quick break. And then when we return, we're going to talk to someone who I'm excited about having on the show, and we'll explain why. Carlos Trujillo is a former ambassador under President Donald Trump's administration. He'll talk about the Trump campaign's efforts to win Latino voters. This is Politically Georgia from the AJC.
Donald Trump has been indicted in Atlanta.
We have so many court dockets to follow, but we haven't really seen anything yet.
The Atlanta Journal-Constitution has covered every moment of this historic case.
I've been writing about this investigation for 2.5 years.
Our team is led by reporters Bill Rankin and Tamar Hallerman. Follow our coverage on AJC.com and listen to new in-depth episodes of the award-winning podcast, Breakdown, The Trump Indictment, only from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
Welcome back to Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Twice daily, delivered straight to your email, you can receive the AJC's Politically Georgia newsletter. Stay on top of all the important news, scoops, and exclusives from me and the rest of the AJC politics team. Just go to AJC.com/newsletters and sign up today. AJC.com/newsletters. I'm Tia Mitchell here with Bill Nygut, and we're going to talk now with former Trump ambassador to the Organization of American States, Carlos Trujillo. Now, Carlos and I go way back to when he was a member of the Florida State House, and he was the appropriations chair. And so when it came budget time, Carlos was the person to know, but he was also always a great person to interview. So it's great. I ran into him at the Capitol recently. I said, we got to have you on the show to talk about President Trump and campaign 2024. And again, as a member of the Latino community, a Cuban American, we want to talk about Latino voters. And Carlos, good morning. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tia. Great to talk to you.
So let's jump right in it. Let's talk. I was reading this morning that the Washington Post reported that Trump and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis met privately recently, and that they're trying to, you know, repair that relationship after, of course, going at each other during the Republican primary. Because I haven't talk to you much. Who have you supported Trump all along? Because you're a Florida guy, you know, did you support Trump all along? And what are your thoughts about whether that rift needs to be repaired in order to unify the party going into this election season?
Yeah, so I've supported Trump obviously since 2016 when he first ran, and that support has never wavered. I've represented him on his New York AG case in New York, the civil case. We're representing him also in the Mar-a-Lago documents case. I served in his administration about 3.5 years. So our friendship and my support has always been there. I think it's important for them to come together. At the end of the day, the Republican Party realizes that, like I think most Americans do, right? It's a binary choice. Either you're happy with the status of this country and the President Biden, or you want some change, and that change is the Republican nominee, which is President Trump. And I think Governor DeSantis, who's done a great job in Florida, has come to that determination. Obviously, political contests sometimes, you know, open up some raw wounds, but I'm happy that they're mending those fences and they're coming together and everyone's getting behind the nominee and hoping on being victorious in November.
So can you talk about your own politics? I mean, I know you're a conservative, clearly a Republican. Do you consider yourself MAGA? Do you consider yourself American First? Let's talk the 2020 election. Do you believe that it was stolen from President Trump? Let's just get it out there, and so we can, you know, set the tone.
Well, it's funny how they try to pigeonhole people into MAGA, America First. Like, what does that all mean? What does being MAGA mean? Do you want to make America great? I think all people want to make America great. I think all people want America to be the greatest country on earth. I think first and foremost, I'm an American, right? I love this country. I want to see this country succeed. My parents were not born in this country. They sacrificed a lot for me and my siblings to be raised in this country. We're very, very grateful for that. And how do you see America succeed? The way you see America succeed is by a strong economic policy. Under President Trump, those 4 years, was the strongest economic growth for all communities, minority communities, affluent communities, poor people, rich people. Everyone was successful when it came to the economic terms under President Trump. And what do people really want is to be safe. I think the majority of Americans, they want safety and security in their communities. They want security at the southern border. And those are two things that President Trump brings and that he was very successful with under his last term. Regarding January, the elections in 2021, look, I think it's easy to blame other people. I think it's important for us as Republicans to reflect on what we could have done better. And I always think it's easy to just look around and say this could have happened or that could have happened. But we didn't use all the resources we had. I think we could have been in a state like Georgia much more aggressive on the get out the vote operations, on bringing people to the polls, on election monitoring. If there's fraud, it's incumbent upon people to denounce it and to bring it forward and to have concrete evidence, right? And I think that's stuff that, whether it happened or didn't happen, no one has brought forward concrete evidence that shows undeniable election fraud, right? Do I think that, like in all elections, right, that some things happen that probably shouldn't have happened? Absolutely. Would it have changed completely the outcome of the election? You know, I don't know. Obviously, President Biden was sworn in. He's a president of the United States. He has 4 years of an economic and foreign policy record that he has to run on. I think it's left a lot to be desired. And I look forward to November, in which President Trump, I think, will not only be the nominee, but also be victorious in the general election.
Ambassador Trujillo, first of all, I'd just like to respond to a little of what you just said. Fraud in the election. You obviously are not in the camp of those who are continuing to say the election was stolen from Donald Trump. At the same time, we should point out that many, 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 many court cases found absolutely no evidence of fraud in the 2020 election. And I think you, as an attorney, understand that. And I want to talk about the fact that you have both a political role and you've been involved with President Trump as an attorney. Your firm is one of the firms that has represented Trump in the documents case unfolding in Florida, as well, I think, as the New York civil case in which Trump was found guilty of misrepresenting his worth and has had to pay this astonishing penalty for that behavior. So you have both that legal role, but you're also considered one of his closest advisors and connections to the Latino community. Have I got it right, those dual roles?
More or less, yeah.
Okay. All right. With that in mind, I'm always interested. I think I'm right, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, that right now, as we move into the election cycle, Latino voters represent about 15% now of the total vote across the country. And we know that in 2020, that Donald Trump was able to increase the percentage of votes from that community in many states. Here in Georgia, that did not happen. So help us understand how the outreach to the Latino community works in 2024. What's the message that Donald Trump and those of you who are surrogates for Trump have for Hispanic voters?
Well, I think it's quite clear, right? Hispanics, just like African Americans, just like white voters, they vote with their pocketbook. Are you better off today in the United States of America than you were 4 years ago? And that's a question they have to answer. Are gas prices more affordable? Is going to the Chick-fil-A more affordable? Is your life more affordable today than it was 4 years ago? And the answer is unequivocally no. If you look at our foreign policy, when they were accusing Trump of we will be in a nuclear war with North Korea, it never happened. We have two full-blown military escalations happening right now, a foreign policy that's absolutely disastrous, a place that I've spent a lot of time in Latin America, a broken system in which we cancel the Keystone Pipeline in the United States because we're concerned about the environmental impact. But at the same time, we grant general licenses to Venezuela that has no environmental standards, that literally is pouring mercury into the water. That's our foreign policy. And our foreign policy at the end of the day, Americans, Latinos, Blacks, everyone votes with their pocketbook and everyone votes at the end of the day with their common sense. And the message to the Latino community, I think to all Americans at large, is, are you better off? And the answer is unequivocally no. There's not a single person right now in New York City who feels safer under Joe Biden. I've spent time in New York City with these legal cases. I can tell you, I wouldn't bring my wife and my daughter through Times Square. This is the United States of America. This is in Tehran. It's absolutely disgusting what's happening in our country, especially in the inner cities and especially in community minority communities. All this illegal immigration that you constantly see, and these, my parents came to this country as immigrants. And I say that obviously immigration is legal. Immigration is great for this country, and immigrants provide a significant amount of opportunities in this country. But this is disastrous, untethered illegal immigration that's happening in our country. It's taking and destroying inner city communities. You see it at the Roosevelt Hotel. When you see hundreds of able-bodied male adults receiving social entitlement, receiving health care, receiving free food, receiving Visa cards, is that fair to the hardworking Americans who are paying taxes? Is that fair to that single mom or to that single father who's literally on the margins of ending up in poverty? Why are their taxpayers going to subsidize people who aren't born in this country, who don't contribute to this country and didn't come to this country legally? And those are questions that the Biden administration has to answer for. And for them to say, well, we're not responsible for this mess. I can tell you, President Trump said his immigration policy was abundantly clear. We're going to build a wall. We're going to stop illegal immigration. And people called them racist and people called them all sorts of terms. Is the Biden administration that committed to stopping illegal immigration? And the answer is they're not.
Can I jump in? Because I want to ask you about immigration, because at the southern border, we know there's been crisis. It, you know, ebbs and flows, but there have been waves of immigrants, but not all of them are, you know, sneaking across as illegal immigration. A lot of them are asylum seekers, which is kind of a different pot of immigration. And it seems that the U.S. policy has long had trouble figuring out what to do about pathways to citizenship and immigration. You know, during the Trump years, there was no immigration overhaul. Yes, there was wall building, but there was no immigration system overhaul to deal with the policy parts. And as a Cuban immigrant,
I would say that there were three particular issues. Number one, there was a policy through executive order called Remain in Mexico. And then there was a third country safe agreement. When people seek asylum, it's not asylum that I want to go to any single place I want to go in the world, right? It's my life is in danger. I am being persecuted for either my religion, my beliefs, my gender, whatever the case may be. And I need to go to the next person's place that will accept me in order to seek this asylum. So how does a person who leaves Haiti, who moves to Brazil, who's currently working in Brazil for 20 years, decides to leave Brazil, show up in Mexico and claim asylum? What about all the countries in between? They couldn't claim asylum in Panama or Nicaragua or Guatemala or El Salvador or Costa Rica or Mexico. They had to make it all the way to our southern border. And that's the problem with these asylum claims. If people are coming from Mexico claiming political asylum, they might have a bona fide case. They might. I'm not saying they will, but they might. But for people to traverse the entire hemisphere and traverse entire continents to then show up at our country, are they really seeking asylum? And the answer is no. They're seeking economic opportunity. There's no legal recognized claim for economic opportunity. No one could just show up and say, I want more economic opportunity, therefore I'm allowed to enter a country legally. So the true bona fide asylum claims, I think, are very, very limited. And under Trump, we had the third country safe agreements. So if you were seeking asylum and you were being persecuted in Mexico, you could seek asylum at our embassy in Guatemala. And Guatemala would take in Mexicans that were seeking asylum because of persecution. If you were Guatemalan, you could go to El Salvador or Honduras or another country and seek asylum. Because the purpose of asylum is to stop political or personal persecution. It's not economic advancement or economic development. And I think that's a problem with a lot of the things they're doing. They're not seeking asylum. It's no more just for a 12 or 13 or 14-year-old girl to be brought from Guatemala to our southern border, trafficked and tortured and raped along the way. Not a single person. And that's what's happening to them. Don't think, I know people say like, oh, they just show up. How do you think they get from whatever country A to the United States southern border? It's not on the magic school bus. These people are mostly women and children are being raped. They're being trafficked. They're being abused. They're being sold into slavery right now because of these failed policies.
So to your point, what's the balance between, of course, wanting to stop the wave, but also the humanitarian response? Because you mentioned people get government assistance. Yes, that's because we say when people show up on our soil, we got to feed them. We got to clothe them. Got to give them a place to lay their head. So, but to your point, a lot of people are concerned that is a drag on many cities and in states and their resources. So what's the balance? If a young girl shows up at the southern border and she's been trafficked or been paid off by people that don't treat her well along the way, what's our responsibility when she arrives at the checkpoint?
So I think, Tia, our responsibility is to make sure she doesn't get there, right? To make sure she doesn't have to go through this treacherous journey of being trafficked and getting all the way there. So I think what we have to really, really do is, if you have these issues in Guatemala, just like we did under the Trump administration, set up third country agreements. You don't have to make it to our southern border. We could provide assistance at a much better place, much safer, much cheaper in other countries. There was a Remain in Mexico policy. You don't have to make it. What they call them is called getaways. They show up at our southern border. We don't even know who these people are. Maybe it's a 13-year-old girl who's been trafficked, or maybe it's a Hezbollah sympathizer. We have no idea. So why can't they remain in Mexico, right? Why can't these people show up in Mexico? They were allowed to remain there. We're able to orderly and legally process them, figure out and adjudicate their asylum claims, and then figure out whether they met the metrics of asylum and whether they're allowed entry into the United States. The first thing the Biden administration did when they came into power, they eliminated all these agreements because Trump did them. So are we concerned more about the political opportunity? Or are we concerned about making our country safe and really controlling illegal immigration? And since then, there's been no agreements that have been put in place with any of these countries. So if we're really concerned about illegal immigration, why don't we do something about it?
Well, Ambassador Trujillo, first of all, I'd really like to ask you, If you maybe made an overstatement that you didn't mean to make, most of the women and young girls who are coming north to the border are being raped, sexually trafficked. You don't really believe that most of these women are being treated this way. It strikes me that's part of an effort, as much of what you're saying here, and God knows there's a crisis at the border, but there's so much fear in the way you're describing this. And I wonder if that's the best way to address the problem that we face at the southern border, by talking about, by planting fear in the minds of Americans as they watch the crisis unfold.
I don't think it's fear, Bill. I think it's reality. Have you spent time in Times Square right now?
Yeah, Times Square is absolutely, I don't think you have. I mean, you're talking about the Times Square of 1970. Ironically, it was Rudolph Giuliani who turned it around.
I wasn't born back then, but I can tell you the Times Square of my lifetime, it wasn't like that. Have you been to the Roosevelt Hotel? But this whole idea that is striking fear. If you spend time with any of these migrants, and I've represented some of them pro bono out of my own time in my own pocket, you could ask them what's happened to them. And it's not one random girl. They're getting trafficked by coyotes and transnational criminal organizations. I could tell you there's no rule of the law. Those people will beat, abuse, and sell them into human slavery. Men, women, children, they don't care. So this idea that this is fear mongering, how do you think they make it across the southern border? These are people in Guatemala who make $2,000 a year. How do they pay a coyote tent? Mm-hmm. They don't pay it with cash. They pay it with their skin, with their lives, with their souls. It's not fear-mongering. If you really spend time in these migrant centers and you talk to these people, I have, and you talk to these people and you ask them about their experience, every single one, and it's heartbreaking to hear the mother say, I would never, ever wish this on anyone, my worst enemy. So the fear-mongering is not only them coming to this country. I think that's something that as humans, right, as Americans, as civilized society, we should be concerned about. But really also, if 1 or 2 or 5% of the 200,000 that are coming in every single day don't have the best intentions, how does that help our country? How does that help our safety and our security?
Ambassador, I appreciate your response to me, but real quick, because I know T is about to call time out on this conversation, you're now promoting Marco Rubio as the best choice for former President Trump to make for his vice presidential running mate. You just got a little time, I know, but could you just give us a quick summary of why Senator Rubio?
Well, look, I think Senator Rubio has significant experience in some of the most important issues, immigration being one of them, foreign policy being another, national security. There are areas he's championed. He has a great track record in the Senate. I think he adds, even though President Trump's from Florida, but that Florida Hispanic Latino movement, he really helps move that vote at the margins. And if you look at a state like Georgia, a state that Trump lost by 10, 12, 14,000 votes, whatever the number is, if Marco Rubio just loses it, 11,000, was that the number?
Find me the votes, 11,700 votes.
All right. So does Marco Rubio move that number with Hispanics 5%, 10%? That makes up these small margins in Arizona, in Nevada, in Georgia. It helps in North Carolina. It makes Virginia competitive. So I think there's a real good political case to be made for Senator Rubio. I think there's a very good policy case, given his track record and given his experience. And I also think he's a candidate who's been vetted at the national stage. He ran a very strong presidential campaign in 2006. Any, you know, national vetting, I think, for the most part, has been done. So I think he puts the president in a much stronger position to win.
Interesting.
All right. Well, we are going to have to wrap it up there. Thank you so much, Ambassador Trujillo, for joining us. We definitely want to have you back on.
Thank you. It was a pleasure being on the show. Appreciate you guys.
All right. And just ahead, Georgia remains a battleground state. Vice President Kamala Harris is making her 12th trip to Georgia today. Greg Bluestein is stationed for her arrival and will give us an update right after the break. This is Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
Our journalists at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution are working around the clock to keep you updated on all the developments surrounding the Trump indictment. Now the AJC is putting all of our coverage in one place with our new Trump 19 newsletter. Every Wednesday, you'll have our latest coverage and analysis on this historic case in your inbox. So sign up for free today at ajc.com/indictment newsletter. That's all one word. ajc.com/indictment newsletter.
Welcome back to Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. The AJC has a special offer for Politically Georgia podcast listeners. If you subscribe today, you can get 3 months of unlimited digital access for just 99 cents. That's all of our breaking news, politics, investigations, business, sports, food and dining, and much, much more. Plus, access to our e-paper, the AJC app, and our assortment of newsletters. So take advantage of the special offer for podcast listeners only by going to ajc.com/start A. That's ajc.com/start and the letter A. This introductory special is for new subscribers only. I'm Tia Mitchell with Bill Nygut. And our colleague, Greg Bluestein, also joins us by phone. Hey, Greg.
Hey, guys, I'm sitting outside the airport waiting for Vice President Kamala Harris's visit to Atlanta.
Yes, and Bill and I talked at the beginning of the show how we're still recovering from this weekend. You made the whirlwind trip for the White House Correspondents' Dinner as well. Are you holding up okay?
I am. My flight got delayed twice. I didn't get home until really late. I should say almost early this morning.
Oh, wow.
But you know how it goes. And woke up and went right back to the airport, this time for another reason.
Yeah, back at it. So, right, you're at the airport waiting for Air Force Two to land. Vice President Harris is making her 12th trip to Georgia since 2021. Let's start there. Why is Georgia, and particularly Metro Atlanta, why is it such a frequent stop, particularly for the vice president?
Yeah, you're so right. I mean, 12 trips in the last 3+ years, and most of them to Atlanta. She's had a couple to Columbus. She has a couple of the other parts of the state, but really focusing on Metro Atlanta. And this event will really stay within a couple miles from the airport. So this will really be an in-town Atlanta visit. And that's because Georgia, of course, is a top target. Georgia flips so narrowly, as you guys just mentioned in the last segment, by fewer than 12,000 votes in 2020. And, you know, Republicans see Georgia as a must win. They don't know how they can win the presidency without Georgia. Democrats, of course, would love to win Georgia, but there's other paths to victory. But they want to keep it in the Democratic fold. And it's going to be real tough for President Biden and Vice President Harris to rebuild that tenuous coalition that propelled his victory 3 years ago here.
Bill, jump in.
Yeah. First of all, Greg, I know you're out at the airport long before the plane lands, which is always interesting to point out to listeners what a glamorous life it is to be a political reporter who waits hours
sitting
sometimes.
In my sedan at a parking lot.
Right. So, Greg, it's interesting. We just, of course, talked to the provost from Morehouse College about the visit of the president there. And I mentioned to him it's interesting that the vice president's visit here today is to highlight the work that the president has done to give more economic empowerment to black men. But we also talked about the fact that, you know, there are Democrats who believe, black Democrats who believe, that it is time for people like Biden to really put their money where their mouth is in working to help the black community. And black men are frequently those who don't vote as enthusiastically for Democrats as black women do.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, black women are the cornerstone of the Democratic Party in Georgia. Black men overwhelmingly vote Democratic as well, but the turnout rates tend to be lower.
Yes.
And the enthusiasm gap is larger. And that's a concern for Joe Biden's campaign. We've said this on the show before. Biden's campaign isn't necessarily worried about Donald Trump getting 20% of the African-American vote in Georgia. They're worried about just low turnout rates in general. They see it as a choice between Joe Biden and the couch, not Joe Biden and Donald Trump. And that's why you're seeing the vice president come back here for the 12th time since 2020 to try to energize that base of support. And today's visit is about the economy. Other visits to battleground states have been about reproductive rights and abortion rights. You've seen in January she visited to focus on voting rights, which is also a core Democratic issue. So she's trying to prioritize the issues that really energize the party's base here in Georgia.
You know, it's interesting, Greg, that for a good 3 years of this administration, Vice President Harris was dismissed quite frequently and also the subject of great criticism, mockery by some Republicans for not being particularly effective, for not really having a handle on the issues that she was asked to take on. And yet, now that we're well into the campaign, the president is really counting on Vice President Harris to be a strong representative out there as she's been in Georgia. It's an interesting turn for Vice President Harris.
You're exactly right. She's not a surrogate. She's a partner, right? And so you're seeing that all over the country. Today's visit kicks off a tour of battleground states just focused on the economy. So today's is the first stop. She's going to be going to a convention center close by to speak in a conversation with the two hosts of Earn Your Leisure, which is a very popular podcast focusing on the economy. And then she'll go to Michigan, and then there'll be other stops on that tour. But, you know, that she has been deployed to very important battleground states all over the nation. And Bill, one other thing to note, she'll be in Florida later on this week, the day that anti-abortion legislation is set to take effect there in Florida, to also highlight the Biden administration's opposition to those abortion restrictions.
Yeah, she's going to Jacksonville, right?
Yep, she's going to Jacksonville on May 1st.
So let's talk. I know we're running out of time, but today's event, it is controlled. It's not open to the public. Like you said, it's being billed as a conversation. We do expect Senators Ossoff and Warnock, Representative Williams to be there. But it seems like with all the unrest going on, the White House is being careful about kind of the event planning side, the logistics side, to control it as much as possible. Do you get that sense? They're live streaming
exactly
it, but
right.
Again, not having it open to the public.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Spot on. They're worried about demonstrators, protests, hecklers who have interrupted events in the past, because they want to keep the focus on the economy and not on Gaza and Israel and the ongoing protests that you guys talked about earlier today in the program.
And so tell us about your day. I mean, you're at the airport. Are you going to be in the motorcade? What you got going on as you follow the vice president around?
You got the glamorous life of a reporter. I'll be watching, documenting her touchdown here. As she lands, I'll join the motorcade for her events. There's not much on the agenda today beyond the conversation. There's no fundraisers or anything like that I know of.
All right. Then
she'll head out of town around 4.
All right. Thanks, Greg. That's all the time we have for today's podcast. You can now hear Politically Georgia live on 90.1 WABE in Atlanta, weekdays at 10 a.m., or follow Politically Georgia on your favorite podcast app and hear new episodes every afternoon. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review and share Politically Georgia with a friend. Join us again tomorrow for Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.